Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz Today.
Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another hour of Tony Katz Today. I am not Tony. I am Andrew Langer, in for him. My last day in for Tony right now. Always enjoy sitting in for Tony on these airwaves. I consider it a privilege. Sending a shout out to my friends and family members up in gorgeous Cass County, Indiana. That's right. Circling around with you guys, you folks in Logansport, Indiana, where the Wabash meets the Eel. Always loving being able to do a shout out to you guys. Yeah, that's right. I got that connection. Can't wait to come out. I need to come in studio, sit in for Tony, get back up to see the good folks up in Logansport and elsewhere in Indiana. Anyway, we've got a great hour coming up on the show. We got Matt Welch from Reason. We're going to talk about the State of the Union. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court with Devin Westhill. Very excited for that conversation as well. But of course, the State of the Union is tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern. Latest State of the Union televised. As my wife said to me, she's like, "It's getting a little later. Why? I thought it was in January. Yeah, it used to be." And then they moved it. They moved it later and later and later. I guess maybe they're hoping for better news in the first quarter. I don't know. But you know, this is where we are. I think that they, well, anyway, they ought to move. I used to say they can either move a tax due date from April into sometime right before the election. I said years ago that the government ought to send a thank you note just before the election, underscoring exactly how much in taxes you've paid in a given year. Folks didn't like that suggestion when I made it about 15 years ago. So while this is going on, of course, the backdrop is this is Joe Biden's last speech, last State of the Union before the election. And obviously they're looking at the polling numbers around them and saying that something different is going on. But clearly they are deeply concerned here. This is a guy named Quentin Folks. He is the campaign spokesman for the Biden campaign. Again, you know, one of the themes that they've been talking about is democracy. We heard the Secretary of State of Colorado the other day talking about how the defense of our democracy is up to the voters. To which I said, "Yeah, no guff. It's always up to the voters." But here is you know, you want to talk about raising the hyperbolic part of the rhetoric here. Here is the Biden campaign spokesman. Let's play cut number three.
I think that, you know, there are a couple of events in history that, you know, transcend politics and are piercing. I think 9/11 is one of those issues that people remember. And I think January 6th is one of those issues. And I think, you know, Donald Trump being, you know, one of the first American presidents to not want to peacefully transition power. It's something that's in the minds of people.
Do you think it will be front and center, the first thing on voters' minds come November?
I think democracy will, and I don't necessarily think that, you know, for every single voter that is January 6th. I think that democracy can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
And they're going to make sure. They're going to make sure that you think of it as January 6th. That's the Democratic theme, right? Joe Biden, listen, he may talk about threats to democracy tonight. I would be shocked if he mentions either President Trump or MAGA. I would be very shocked if he wastes the precious time of the State of the Union to talk about those things this evening. But you can bet, right? Just as you can bet that they are going to tout this idea that Joe Biden's done more in his first 3 years than most presidents do in their two terms, and that's somehow a good thing. Just as you can bet that they're going to ignore the very obvious signs of cognitive decline in this president, they're going to make sure that this election is about democracy and protecting democracy, because that's, you know, for them that, and again, right, it's not about large swatches of people. I don't know how much I've talked about this in the last week. This election is going to come down to moving small groups of people from column A to column B in a handful of states and in a handful of localities in those states. And what they want to do is they want, in those independent voters, those college-educated, independent, suburban women, they want to just raise a little bit of a doubt about what Donald Trump is going to do, right? Don't think about what the administration is doing in order to change the cultural narrative. Don't think about porn in schools. Don't think about the fact that your daughters are playing against boys who want to pretend they're girls in order to play sports. Don't think about any of those other things. Don't think about the threat that illegal immigrants pose to your communities. Don't think about how our economic policies are either driving up the cost of things or are making the portion sizes of the things you buy smaller. Don't think about any of those things. Focus on democracy and that Donald Trump is some threat to democracy. Let me say something on this score. Another great myth that the Democrats have been putting out. If Donald Trump is a fascist, if he is an authoritarian, he's really bad at it. Because the one thing that defines an authoritarian is the consolidation of power into the executive branch of whatever government is that they're taking over and expanding that power. The more power the government has, by definition, the more authority it has over your daily lives. And when you say a government has increasing authority over your daily life, that is an increasingly authoritarian government. I want to be really clear about this. I was a Donald Trump skeptic going into the 2016 election. I was. He was not my first candidate then. He wasn't my first candidate in 2024, frankly. And I did not buy. God, I've been to this dance before. I'd had politicians promise me, promise me personally, by the way, that they were going to work to decrease the size and scope of federal government power, which is the greatest threat to individual rights. Every time you increase the power of government, individual rights are diminished. Well, Donald Trump promised these things. I didn't expect him to deliver on them, but he did. That's the thing that gets me. Set aside everything else. Set aside his boorishness. Set aside his bravado. Set aside his bizarre speech. Set aside his hair. Set aside his marriages. Set aside his peccadilloes. At the end of the day, for me, in the work that I do on regulatory policy, Donald Trump was the first president ever in my lifetime to keep the size of the administrative state constant. So if he's an authoritarian, he's a really bad authoritarian. Because he's the only authoritarian who didn't work to increase the power of the central authority in people's lives. Now, I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. Maybe I'm myopic because I'm only focusing on certain things. I tend to think that I'm not. I've been doing this now, this work, for over 30 years. I think I got a pretty good indication as to how you gauge the depth of government power. So yeah, if Donald Trump's an authoritarian, he's a really, really bad one. Democracy's on the ballot. Yeah, we'll have to ask Matt Welch about that. Real quick, let's hear what Chris Coons had to say about Biden's trouble in Michigan. Let's play cut number four.
I was just campaigning in Michigan last weekend, Neil, and what's striking is on the ground, the folks I was listening to, the impact on their lives of advanced manufacturing plants, of new investments in infrastructure, of a double-digit wage increase for auto workers. The communities I was in Michigan are feeling
right.
And
all right,
seeing.
Enough. You can stop that one. The double-digit wage increase for auto workers whose jobs we are trying to destroy. And again, that's not hyperbole. That's a fact. It takes fewer auto workers to make electric cars than it does to make cars that have internal combustion engines. The auto workers know this. This is why they've pushed back so heavily. It's part of the reason why the Biden administration has pulled back on their EV mandates. Because they're under enormous pressure, not from the automakers themselves, but from the auto workers' unions. Oh, my God. Anyway, we're going to talk about these lies with Matt Welch. He's the editor of Reason Magazine. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. Welcome back, everybody. I am Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz today. I am very excited to have our guest on. It's one of my favorite people, and I don't talk to him nearly enough. His name is Matt Welch. He is the editor-at-large of Reason Magazine and Reason.com, the author of a book that literally changed my life. He knows this. He's heard this before as I kiss his posterior on this. The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. It's the book that made me reconsider whether or not I should be a Republican Party official. And for that, I thank him greatly because he was absolutely right. Matt, man, I mean, we're on a precipice here. I've been unpacking the lies that are being told about the state of the economy. Joe Biden, let's start here with the talking point is Joe Biden has done more in his first 3 years than most have done in his first in their two terms in office. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. I think you might agree. What are your thoughts here?
I mean, I just was looking through State of the Union addresses of historically, as I tend to do around this time of the year, although usually it's in January, right?
Or February. Yeah, that's right.
excuse me. But Harry Truman, in his first 3 years, America, let's see, dropped the bomb, ended the war, created NATO, the Marshall Plan, about 75 other multilateral institutions. I think that was a little bit more of a thing, whether you love all those things or hate them, but they basically created the post-World War II order. Enough already with the, I mean, they used to do that with Hillary Clinton, right? She's the most qualified candidate in the history of mankind. It's ridiculous. It's almost as ridiculous as watching Joe Scarborough saying on MSNBC yesterday, as he did, that right now, this is the best version of Biden.
And if you don't believe that, F you. That was my favorite part of it, which is,
If you don't believe it, F you. There's a thing that both parties have been doing, not necessarily in equal measure, but frequently and more than they did 10 years ago, which is insisting that the things that you see with your own eyeballs are not happening, and in fact, the opposite is true.
Yeah, what are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Yes, that's exactly right. I'm sorry, Matt, go ahead.
No, just that's where we live in right now. The Republican Party has serially rallied around someone whose presidency, in my mind, the tone for it was set the day after his inauguration, when he forced poor Sean Spicer to go in and lie and about what our lying eyes showed us at the inauguration, which is the size of the crowd now compared to Obama's, and now we're doing that with Joe Biden. He's super sharp. Boy, you should see him behind closed doors. He can do one-handed push-ups and all this.
Jack Palance, he's not.
They call it Operation Bubble Wrap. That's what the White House insiders call their treatment of Biden. They're shielding him to a historical degree away from press conferences, away from unscripted moments, reporters. They have Jill Biden sitting in the front row almost every single time that he's anywhere where he might actually say something. You'll see him. He'll like let slip, like, oh, I'm not supposed to answer questions. I'll get into trouble. Mommy's going to be mad? That's really strange. And so tonight, I think one of the interesting things will be the lying eyes test, because people have been talking for understandable reasons over the past month of, like, my God, dude's looking pretty old, and old enough so that that affected him not being prosecuted for mishandling government documents. And so they've been shielding him. They didn't even have him in the Super Bowl, like softball interview, like, oh, we don't want to bother you with politics. Yeah, right. So it's going to be a lying eyes moment filled with a bunch of just garbage micro initiatives about, like, I'll give you a $5,000 tax credit if you buy your first new house, and we're going to cut your junk fees on credit card late somethings by $8 a month. You know, is this the leader of the free world? That's what he should be doing. It's an awful pageantry.
But see, that's just it, Matt. Here's the thing that I come back to, which is, you know, there's the old adage, we get the candidates we deserve. And it seems to me that now would be the moment for that third party candidate, Libertarian Party candidate, a no labels candidate or what have you. But then you look at, you know, you've got RFK, who we've had a series of non-libertarian candidates for president in the last few cycles, but RFK might be pursuing the Libertarian Party nomination. I don't know. There's somebody else. You got that whole problem with the Mises Caucus in the Libertarian Party. You got no labels, not able to attract a candidate out there for a whole host of reasons. Why can we not get, why can't Americans not get a credible non-Republican, non-Democrat candidate running for office?
Well, you know, one could argue that Gary Johnson was a pretty decent candidate a couple of times for the Libertarian Party, and he did pretty well, their best ever showing in 2016. I think that this year is the most fertile ground for a third-party candidacy since at least 1996 and Ross Perot, and maybe even 1992. RFK has consistently been polling, you know, 13%, 14%, something like that. He's not my ideal candidate. I think he has no chance of becoming the Libertarian Party nominee, by the way. I think it's a lot of people on the Libertarian side trying to do a shortcut to ballot access when they're floating his name.
Sure.
But I think that so RFK is definitely a factor in this race. No Labels now is coming out and saying that they are likely to enter the race when their secret delegates meet in a secret meeting tomorrow to decide secretly about something. They haven't announced anyone, and everybody who's like a putative candidate has basically run away screaming, like Joe Manchin and Larry Hogan. Now they're saying, boy, Kristen Sinema, she sure looks fetching in those glasses, but I doubt that she will want that either. But they'll be on there. I think history will show that one of the biggest missed opportunities was for the Libertarian Party to have like an institutional civil war right now.
Right.
Imagine the same Mish Libertarian Party that had kind of muddled through, but also
right.
became by far the best and most successful third party that we've seen in a long time. You know, they've three straight bronze medal finishes. They now have a triple the size of party registration than the Green Party. They've been pretty successful in their way. They win all 50 states compared to the other parties and independent candidates. They could have just kind of kept going in that direction and then nominated Justin Amash.
Right.
Instead of having Justin Amash go back to the Republican Party and enter a crowded Michigan primary, I think a youth and a talented, young, smart candidate and principled like Amash could have been a difference maker, but I think we are destined. I mean, you said before, like, we get the politics we deserve. You forgot the proper ending to that sentence, which is good and hard.
Yes.
Which is, you know, we're screwing it up. Whatever the worst case scenario is, bet on that.
Well, here's what I said this yesterday. I've decided in 2028, I'm going to take whatever funds that I have available to me, and I'm going to mount a primary challenge, and I'm going to go for the gold and win American Samoa. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to eke out that primary victory by investing my money in American Samoa, just so I can say I won a presidential primary.
I think that is a quality use of money. If we're going to have these bad politics, we might as well entertain ourselves.
Yes.
And that's much better than the clinical depression and degenerative alcoholism that the rest of us are drifting
toward. I mean, it's a situation. Here's what I come back to. You know, coming back to these two candidates and coming back to this talking point that Crenshaw Pierre and others have used about Joe Biden doing more. One of the measurements that I use is the cost of regulation. And to me, you know, sort of this expression that, and I said this earlier, that every time government grows, individual rights are diminished. There's a corollary to that, which is you can't reconcile liberty with anti-liberty. The regulatory state has certainly grown by leaps and bounds under Joe Biden. You know, $750 billion, our colleagues at the Competitive Enterprise Institute have estimated. I mean, that's a massive expansion. We've got to do something about that, Matt, don't we?
Yes, and to his credit, Donald Trump consistently runs against that. He's always talking about dismantling the administrative state for a variety of different reasons. And he had a deregulatory record that surprised most people, including
me.
At CEI at the beginning of his presidency. However, regulation is a thing that extends to other areas in which he is decidedly anti-liberal on immigration, on trade. If you put a 10% tariff on everything, that's a regulation, my dude. And that's a bad one. Makes everything a lot more expensive. You can't really run against inflation and high prices and then make everything 10% more expensive. That doesn't really add up. So, Biden and the Democrats right now, I mean, his pre-baked State of the Union talking points look like an Elizabeth Warren wish list.
Hey, Matt, we got to leave it there. I appreciate it, my friend. We got to keep in touch. You take care.
Thank you.
Matt Welch, editor-at-large, Reason Magazine and Reason.com. I'm Andrew Langer. When we come back, going to be joined by Devin Westhill, president and general counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. This is Tony Katz Today. Welcome back, everybody. I am Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz. Oh, sorry, guys. I'm fighting the battle of Facebook. It's been a couple of days now. I'm finally at that stage where I was able to send in a picture of my driver's license to get verified. This is just crazy stuff. Anyway, the little things that come out. I got to reach back out to Matt because I got an idea about third-party candidates I want to talk to him about. Anyway, hi, everybody. So we're joined right now by Devin Westhill. He is president and general counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity. He focuses on matters of constitutional and civil rights. We had a bit of a disappointment. We've had a very good string of victories with the Supreme Court. If you're someone who's interested in free market principles and limited government principles and principles of rationality when it comes to the law, the Supreme Court has generally been very good. We've had one disappointment recently, which is that the Supreme Court did not take up a case involving a magnet high school in Northern Virginia called the Thomas Jefferson High School of Science and Technology. They instituted new DEI analyses of applicants, and these were challenged. The Supreme Court did not take up that case. Devin, why did this happen? Talk about the disappointment there.
Well, Andrew, thank you for having me on. Well, I can't really tell you why it didn't happen, right? The Supreme Court operates in the way in which it feels most appropriate and doesn't always explain to us why it doesn't take up certain cases. But what I will tell you is that there are two justices who wanted to take it up and actually issued what might be described as a blistering dissent. Yep. From denial. Justices Samuel Alito and Justice Clarence Thomas were those two judges saying, you know, the way in which the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which was the court that had this case before it went up to the Supreme Court for review, potential review, said that they had it patently incorrect. And, quote, it was a dangerous understanding of what showed to prove intentional race discrimination. I can't tell you what the rest of the justices were thinking, but the two oldest justices on the court and none of the Trump appointees, it's clear how they saw taking up this case.
It's of personal interest to me, Devin, because when I went to college, the first graduating class out of TJ, as it's known in Virginia, was my year of high school. And out of a class of 160, I'm sorry, out of a class of 360, 60 of them were in my freshman class at William & Mary. And I knew a lot of them. And I knew folks from the subsequent classes. And they were all kinds of different people, different races, different genders, etc. But they all had one thing in common. They were all singularly brilliant people. And you know, obviously, TJ, that's who they are. They were one of the first high schools in America to get a Cray supercomputer. They had a genetic biology lab on campus for kids to work with. Why is it that the left is so hell-bent on changing the standards by which people? Let me go to a more general question, Devin. Why does the left want to get rid of meritocracy in America?
Well, I mean, that really is a good question. I think the answer really boils down to the data. The data suggests that, and interests. The data suggests that black and brown kids, on the whole, right, black and Hispanic kids especially, test lower on standardized testing. They have lower GPA and so forth, so they're less competitive. And getting into magnet schools like TJ, TJ being for many years the top high school in the country. And I think based on your reading of it, it unfortunately is going to suffer as a result of this and many other magnet schools as well, but colleges and universities as well. Want to have that racial diversity on campus, right, on the one hand, but they can't get it through merit alone because the data suggests that that's not possible. And so they design these types of engineering schemes to get the outcome they're looking for. It's the difference, right, between equality of opportunity and equity of outcome. Mm.
The other part of this that gets me about this, and a lot of folks don't understand, I'm hoping you can comment on this, is the more they re-engineer these qualifications to make them subjective, the more that they can game the system for whatever political ends they want, right? It gets back to the line from the movie Gangs of New York. It's not the number of ballots that were cast. It's who does the counting that counts, to use the word twice. You create these subjective terms, and they could be perverted and subverted in any way that somebody wants them to, can't they?
And I think that's really one of the problems that we have to put our finger on here. So the vast majority of the country, right, are good people. I mean, Americans, one of the things that make us exceptional is that we're really a kind-hearted people. We've done a lot over the years to export that kind of kindness and our principles around the world as well. And so at the end of the day, what people look at are, okay, I understand there are disparities that fall along racial lines. What can we do to change those things? And that's when efforts like racial affirmative action and DEI step in to kind of take advantage of that generosity of the American people, who otherwise would like to see something done, but then they pervert it, they corrupt it for their own purposes, and that's a really dangerous thing. It's something that we have to continue to highlight, make sure that the average person that doesn't make this their business to study understands what's occurring here.
We're talking with Devin Westhill. He's the president and general counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. I would be remiss, Devin, if I didn't ask you to talk a little bit about the Center for Equal Opportunity. But more importantly, you guys have a fellowship program that takes place over the summer. The fellowship applications are open now. The deadline is March 31. Talk about that and talk about the organization. Talk about that fellowship.
Well, I'm so glad that you asked about that, Andrew. So the Center for Equal Opportunity, our website's at ceousa.org. CEO is a small nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, but we've been around for almost 30 years now, and we've been fighting for one thing that entire time, and that is to promote colorblind equal opportunity and non-discrimination in this country. We've done it by producing studies and holding to account federal, state, and government bodies that try to treat us differently because of our race or other immutable characteristics like that that don't really say anything about our character. So we've been fighting that for a long period of time. And now what we're trying to do is develop a pipeline of new lawyers who are interested in doing this type of equal protection work. And we're
love
in our third year of our Civil Rights Fellowship over the summer. We hope law students will come to our website and apply.
Listen, it is vital. I know the work that I do outside of the radio work, the Center for Regulatory Freedom at the CPAC Foundation, we use legal fellows. I love that. I've always loved working with students on these things and getting them excited. To me, it's funny. I don't have a JD, Devin. There are times when I'm glad I don't have a JD. There are times that I wish I'd gone and finally pulled that trigger and gotten it. But this is the kind of work that I would love to be doing had I gotten that law degree. This conservative, free market, limited government, public interest law, the work that you guys are doing, the work that some of these other organizations are doing, it is vital. So, listen, thank you very much for the work that you do. What's the website?
The website is ceousa.org. Pleasure to talk with you.
Take care. I'm having one of those. I'm having one of those days. That was Devin Westhill. He's the president and CEO of the Center for Equal Opportunity. ceousa.org. I'm Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz. This is Tony Katz Today. Making me laugh there, Carl. Thank you very much for this. I'm Andrew Langer. Oh, my God. We've got just a couple of minutes left, and then the stint of being done. I'm not sure if Tony's back tomorrow or he's back on Monday. Either way, I can't be around tomorrow. Got stuff going on. Anyway, so let me go here to close this out, because this is a good way to sort of end all of this, is to talk about Corinne Jean-Pierre. So, Carl, we're going to be ready with 13 and 14 here. It's a situation, as we said, we got the State of the Union tonight. We got this back and forth. We got this narrative. And one of the real questions in this election is whether or not we're ever going to see Trump and Biden up next to each other on a stage doing debating. Now, I think it's going to happen, but I think there is a strong possibility that this could be the first election in many, many years in which we don't have that happen. Peter Ducey asked Corinne Jean-Pierre about this, and here's what she had to say. Let's play cut 13.
Just for clarity, it's possible that there will be no Joe Biden, Donald Trump debates.
Is that what you're excited about? Is that what you want to see? Because you keep asking
Joe
me. You've asked me
Donald
about
Trump
three,
debate.
Four, or five different times in different ways,
How would President Biden do in a debate? I'm not asking a question about a specific debate. Would he do in a debate?
I know
it's
something?
Been 4 years since
you
he's done.
You literally saw just last year, back in January 2023, at the last State of the Union, take on Republicans during giving a major speech. He took them on as they were heckling him. He took them on and said he was going to fight for programs, essentially said he was fighting for programs that the American people needed. Social Security,
okay,
Medicare.
All right. So no answer there, and turns the question back on Peter Ducey. No, none of us want a situation. None of us wants a situation, Corinne Jean-Pierre, in which the sitting president of the United States does not debate the former president of the United States if they're running against each other. And turning it like that is just bizarre. Fundamentally bizarre. I mean, it's very political. We understand why you're doing it, because you don't want to answer the question, because you just don't know, and you don't want to go back to your trope of I don't have anything on that, which you have to use so many times because they either keep you in the dark or you're not understanding what's going on. Somebody hit this to me. This is a clip, and again, I preface this by saying we don't like to punch downward. But there, you know, this... I sometimes wonder if these are real people doing these jobs. There's something very strange about the way Corinne Jean-Pierre laughs. Let's play cut number 14.
Okay.
You know, that's all right. You know, I did my laugh yesterday, my Jim Carrey laugh, that fake laugh. I mean, it also sounds like, I don't know if any of you are watching the TV show Resident Alien. We like watching it. It's pretty good. Anyway, Alien comes to Earth. He's supposed to destroy the Earth. He can't do it. He's sort of stuck here. The Alien's played by Alan Tudyk, and he's got this very awkward fake laugh that he uses, which if I'd been smart, I would have pulled for all of you. But the point is, I don't need to, because if you want to imagine Alan Tudyk's laugh, all you have to do, in fact, go ahead. Let's play cut number 14 again.
Okay.
That's what his laugh sounds like. Anyway, we can stop it there. It is just very, very strange. Here's an interesting one that I maybe this will be the last clip of the day, and then we'll talk a little bit about how you can find out more about me and the work that I'm up to. Again, having talked about these lies, Corinne Jean-Pierre talking about the programs that people need, they don't need, some of them want. The Democrats need these plans because, again, that's what Democrats do. That's what they're good at, is taking money out of your pocket and giving it to somebody else in the forms of goods, services, or cold hard cash. But we know that Bidenomics doesn't work. You know who else? No. Oh, by the way, great little story here. Side note. Somehow the Biden team did not get, they did not buy Bidenomics.com, Bidenomics.org, etc. The good folks at Americans for Prosperity did. When I saw that headline Biden didn't own, but Team Biden didn't own Bidenomics.com, I'm like, I bet it's AFP. Anyway, Adam Schiff on CNN was talking about Bidenomics. Let's play cut 6.
Well, you know, I think if our campaign and success in a state like California is any indication, he needs to emphasize what he has done, and what he has done has been remarkable. The most aggressive effort to combat climate change in history, the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS and Science Act that brought back so many jobs and continues to, but also how he'll continue to address these challenges that people are facing. People are working harder than ever and still struggling to pay the rent or pay their mortgage or put food on the table. So both what he has done, which is remarkable, what he is going to do, and I think the contrast also
between someone as good and wise and decent in Joe Biden with, you know, someone who has no ethical compass in Donald Trump is going to spell victory at the end of the day.
Did he just say that Joe Biden is wise and decent? I mean, good Lord. I mean, I know the man's old, but he's not, you know, to call him a sage is astounding to me. Somebody is wise and decent, in contrast with a gentleman with no moral compass. No more. Yes, you save 10% for the big guy. That doesn't mean anything. No, he's wise and decent. He calls people a lying dog-faced pony soldier when they challenge him, but no, he's wise and decent. He wants to take money out of people's hands to give it to, you know, take money out of the pockets of working people to give it to the children of the privileged and wealthy. But he's wise and decent. And they don't understand the connection between what they're doing and the fact that people are struggling. That's the damning thing in all of this. In the end, they don't understand. You know, Adam Schiff goes and says, you know, people are struggling. They're earning their money, but it's buying them less stuff. You know, the stuff that they need. That means Bidenomics isn't working. They're struggling to pay their rent. Bidenomics isn't working. When you put, I should have said this earlier. The point of regulation, Democrat histrionics aside, the point of regulation is to make things more expensive. It makes doing the wrong thing more expensive, so it's cheaper to do the right thing. So to say regulation doesn't have a cost is idiotic. It defies reality. In any case, guys, it has been a thin slice of heaven. As I said, I love working with you all, being with you all, being invited into your homes, your cars, your garages, your offices, wherever you're listening to Tony Katz today. I am Andrew Langer. I am, in addition to doing the radio work that I do, I am director of the Center for Regulatory Freedom at CPAC, the folks who put on the big CPAC conference. You can go and check us out, CPAC.org/regulatory freedom. Follow me on Facebook, or Andrew Langer Show. Follow me on Twitter or X, @Andrew_Langer. I do 3 podcasts, as I've mentioned. So if you've enjoyed what you've heard here, listen to Andrew and Jerry Save the World or watch it on YouTube. Me with my buddy Jerry Rogers, the editor of Real Clear Policy, my best friend. If you're interested in long-form interviews, go and check out the Lunch Hour with Federal Newswire. Lots of good stuff coming up there, you know, 30 to 45 minutes on the important issues of the day with the important people of the day. My Swamp Secrets podcast on CPAC Now. Go and check that out at CPAC as well. Listen, I want to thank the good people here at Tony Katz's home station of WIBC, Carl and Jason and Matt and everybody else who's made it possible. Glad that Tony is coming back safe and sound. Until we meet again, folks, please, as I always say, have fun and stay safe.